Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American, all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 28th of January, Anno Domini 2012, and you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 3 minutes after the hour, we're going to be bringing you news, views, stuff to choose, and nothing to lose. Kick off your shoes and lose those blues, because we're going to do the news. Remember when seeing an iPad on a bus, an airplane, or the subway was a startling new experience? Now you might be startled not to see one. Over the holidays, so many people bought tablets for each other and presumably themselves that U.S. tablet ownership nearly doubled among adults to 19% in January from 10% a month earlier. The rate is growing quickly. In May 2010, shortly after the debut of the iPad, only about 3% of computer consumers over the age of 16 owned tablets, according to survey information from the Pew Internet and American Life Project. Pew, pew, pew.
Huh?
Never mind. The survey found a similar jump in e-reader ownership as prices dropped below $100 for electronic book readers from Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Nearly 20% of U.S. adults now own an e-reader, up from 10% in November. Tablet and e-reader adoption continues to grow quickly, just as sales of traditional personal computers slow and even decline.
Yep.
In the U.S., PC sales last year had their worst year since 2001. Dropping nearly 5% compared with 2010, according to research firm IDC. Analysts and PC industry executives regularly cite the increasing popularity of tablets when talking about the slowing growth of the PC business. According to the survey, tablet adoption is now the highest among wealthier and more educated buyers. About 36% of those making more than $75,000 a year own a tablet computer, compared with about 16% of those making $30,000 to $50,000, although ownership rates in both groups appear to be growing quickly. The discrepancy is also substantial between college graduates, 31% of whom own tablets, and high school grads at 15%. So our question to you at soundbites.org, that's bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is do you own a tablet or e-reader? Your choices are yes, more than one, not yet, can't imagine it, and e-what now? Now, once you're done with that question, I know you, you garrulous group, and so you will have more to say. So when you are done voting, and so far, by the way, we have 30 people who voted. 37% of you said not yet, and 23% so far have said yes, 17% more than one. Only 10% of you have said I can't imagine it. But once you're done with that poll, you're probably going to want to say more, and so check in the yellow box underneath the poll. Click on Give Us Your Opinion. It will take you to a truly great website where you can then enter your opinion. The question there, of course, is which tablet or e-reader do you have and how do you like it? And, of course, that's our question to you. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299 or toll-free at 1-800-790-0415.
I thought I was becoming like you, hearing these extra voices in my head.
Uh-huh.
It was next door. They had the volume turned up, so I'm hearing the radio show in the other room.
Nice.
A few seconds later, it's like,
nice.
Wait a minute.
For me, it's tinnitus. For you, I can't help you. I don't know what your problem
is. I'm beyond help anyway. Yeah,
clearly.
So hell.
Clearly. I tell you, I own a Nook, Color.
Mm-hmm.
Nook,
the color? How do you like that
color?
One?
I love it.
Now, wait a minute. Who owns it, you or your wife?
Actually, I do.
Really?
I do.
And you get to use it?
I own it. I own it, and I get to use it. She prefers the feel of real books. I do, too, but the convenience, the ease of being able to take 20 books with me on a trip, you know? The problem, of course, is the ease and convenience with which you can buy a book.
Yeah.
So you get started in a series, and you think, oh, great, the next one's only $8.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, you think, oh, great, the only one's only $7.99.
Mm-hmm.
That's only $7. That and of course, it's not.
That can be one of the dangers of the Kindle Fires is you buy it on the Amazon store. They know your credentials. So when it shows up, it's already logged into your account, and one-click buy is already turned on.
Yep.
So don't give it to your kid.
That's exactly right.
They need to add something. Well, they need to add, you know, password before confirming a purchase.
And the Nook has that.
The Nook has that. The iPad has that,
yep.
too.
Well... Up to
well,
a point.
Well, yeah, you have to add a. Yeah, right. You have to put your password in, and then you don't for 15 minutes.
Right.
It used to be longer, but they shortened it to 15 after a lot of complaints from parents about bills being run up.
Yep. Now, we had. There should be. You know, they're a computer company. You'd think they'd have a programmer on staff so they could say, you know, for games, you have to put in your password every time. For books, it'll last for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, that's not actually hard to do.
Right.
But apparently, you know, that would actually take some thought on their part.
Amazon apparently has said, I read this third hand, that they don't want to detract from the customer experience by making them type their password in.
Yeah. We'd hate to distract from the customer experience by making it secure for you.
So you buy anything you want as often as you want, as fast as you want.
Well, I did notice one thing.
That's not the customer experience. That's the sales experience.
Yeah. I had a friend. I was helping him set up his so he could get his iTunes off. He's got a little iPod, and he had gotten a gift card for Christmas. So we had him go in and create the account and then put in, you know, scratch off the gift card number and all that.
Be careful you don't scratch too much off.
No, right. No, he got that all in, but then when he tried to log in, it was giving him issues, and I was telling him, well, maybe just because you just recreated the account, might have to take a little time. I haven't checked with him to see if it's working.
You can create an iTunes account without a credit card.
Yeah.
It's tricky, though.
It's tricky, but well, you can do it.
Well, we just did it because it said, you know, with a credit card or gift card.
We selected the gift card.
Right. It let us apply, you know, put the number in and said okay.
Right. But actually using neither a gift card or a credit card is tricky. Because basically you're creating your account so you can buy stuff. So it makes sense to have payment information online. But one of the tricks we tell our customers is use an iTunes card, which has a limit, you know, $15, $20, whatever dollars you want on it. Don't attach your credit card to it, which has no limit, in case your kids happen to get old. Well,
that's exactly
limit,
right.
Exactly, yeah. No, I tell folks all the time. That way, if you're worried about, you know, well, I want my credit card out there. Well, that's fine. You don't have to. You just...
Bless you. Oh, still does.
Yeah. You know, it's a lot safer, like Steve's saying. You know, it's a limit.
Exactly.
But I didn't know if there was a time delay when you first set up an account. You know,
there shouldn't be.
There shouldn't be, a couple seconds at most.
I'll have to check with them again.
We did have an issue with a customer. Apparently, she left on a trip right after she bought her iPad and had. I didn't know this at the time, but she called and said she was having trouble registering her iPad. And she typed in her zip code, and it kept saying invalid zip code.
Because she's not there.
Right. She was in Seattle.
Yeah.
And apparently the GPS and the Wi-Fi location, it still should let you set up your home address if it's not in your current...
Apple is not good at letting you do things they don't want you to do.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but it just... I'm a little down on Apple this week after my experience, but...
I actually had two calls like that. She's telling me the problem. I'm, you know, telling her a few things to try. And I said, oh, we'll bring it in. We'll take a look at it. Well, I can. I'm in Seattle. Okay, what do you want me to do about it? Well, I bought it from you. I want you to fix it. Okay, bring it in. We'll take a look at it.
Yeah, bring it in tomorrow, and we'll
tell you. Right, I told her to call the local Apple store. He was actually trying to set up her Verizon Wi-Fi account, not Wi-Fi cellular, and I think that might have been the bigger issue.
Yeah.
But then I had a similar call last week where a gentleman called and said he's having trouble with his battery. For 5 years, his laptop battery's been working fine, and then a couple of days ago, it just stopped working. So I said, well, the battery's probably worn out. Well, it's been working fine for 5 years. Yeah, things work fine until they don't. And then we'll bring it in. We'll take a look at it. Oh, I can't bring it in. I'm in China.
Yeah.
Okay. Again, what do you want me to do about it now?
Yeah. And of course, and what device was this?
A laptop.
Oh, that's all right then.
Yeah. So again, you know, I was joking with him. You're in China. Go to the manufacturing plant. You're probably.
Yeah, exactly.
Although China's
you're
a
there.
Huge country. Yeah, you know, it's like we tell
dodge
people,
the bodies falling out of the windows and go into the store and see what you can
like.
Do.
We tell people we're from New York, and you know they assume New York City. And oh, do you know here? Yeah. No, New York's a big state too.
I did. I was in St. Louis, And somebody, you know, we were talking, and where are you from? Oh, I'm from Rochester, New York. New York, do you know such and so? My brother lives in the city. As it turns out, I did.
Yeah.
Oh! Well, I got to ask, you know.
And so I said, yeah, we all know each other in New York.
Yep.
He lives on whatever street it was in Manhattan.
Even a little closer defined. You know, I was on a trip one time, and somebody said, where you work? I says, Kodak. Oh, I got a friend that works at Kodak. You know so-and-so?
Yeah.
This is back when there was over, 68,000 employees
there. Yeah, we all have lunch together every day. Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, it's a big company.
Orgies Friday afternoon. Yeah. Not a problem. Mm-hmm. All right.
Well, I was going to say, back to the iPad sale, or the tablet sales for a minute, and Apple's quarterly results, an interesting statistic is iPod sales dropped 21%.
Yep.
More and more people are now buying tablets, you know, multifunction tablets with bigger screens than they are iPods.
I can't tell you the number of kids that I see at RIT who now their headphones, and a lot of kids are using real headphones now.
Yeah.
It's better sound.
Sounds better, yeah.
But their headphones don't go to their belt or their pocket anymore. It goes to their backpack. Yep. And I know they're plugged into iPads.
Right. Or even now cell phones, iPhones, Android phones, that can also be your music player. So
So
the standalone MP3 player is probably not long for this world.
Yeah. I'm doing a lot of Pandora.
Well, the tablets, and like you say, also the Nooks.
Yep.
I had a friend, she just got one of the Nooks. And, you know, downloading books and that and just having the comfort of going, wandering around, you know, is great.
Yep.
Being able to just have a book there and going to the library, download them for free.
Yep.
There's an app that you can then get the books right from the library free.
Yep.
And, you know, whether you're sitting in your bedroom and laying in bed, want to read for a little bit, or in the living room, you can take it wherever you want and then still look up stuff, email.
The Nook has an interesting feature that, since they're partnered with Barnes & Noble, if you go into a Barnes & Noble store, you can read any book on the Nook electronically for free, as long as you're in the store, just like you could pull a book off the shelf and read it.
Right. One of the things I love about the Nook really is the form factor. The size is just right. The 7-inch form factor, to me, is the perfect size. As my eyes get older, maybe not, but right now I can read everything I want to read. I've got a Honeycomb, an Android 3.0 version for it, so I can just pop in a CD, a mini SD card, and reboot, right? Mm-hmm. Turn it on, turn it off before you put in the SD card. Put the mini SD card in, turn it on, and I'm suddenly in Honeycomb. And that works fine. It's a tiny bit slow, but it's a mod from some guy, and what do you expect? And that's fine, but it works great. And a 7-inch tablet, it would seem to me, would really be the fine thing to have.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking forward to the 7-inch tablets that are coming out. A half a dozen companies have them. There's one called AINOVO. I don't really know how you pronounce that. Ainovo. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But they've got a couple. One of which is only $99. The other, which is like $110.
I've got a friend that bought one of those $99, I think it's a 5-inch tablet a couple of years ago.
Oh, they're crap.
It's crap.
They're absolute crap.
And so she bought.
Tell me how you really feel.
She bought an iPad and gave the crap tablet to my wife.
Yeah, well, nice. Very, very lovely. Very nice.
Why, she
it better
been
a
wife?
White elephant Christmas gift, because that's the only way that's acceptable. I'm looking forward to a couple of them. I played with one. One of our faculty members bought one. In China, that was $99. And when they first came out, and oh my heavens, you could barely turn the thing on. It was just junk. But it was fun to play with. I mean, you know, it was a $99 tablet at the time when the cheapest ones were $500. Now we're seeing a half a dozen companies are coming out. Asus is coming out, I think, with one, and Lenovo, I believe. Toshiba has a 7-inch tablet that I'm very, 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 very eager to get my hands on, frankly. But we'll see, you know, what that means in the future as to whether people prefer the 7-inch form factor and whether Apple will come out with one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, something to fit in your pocket is nice, but when you're I don't know, movies and books are nicer on the big screen, but it's heavier, so that you've got that trade-off. Of course, I can see Apple coming out with a 7-inch version, so you buy both.
Of course, because it's Apple.
I'm sorry, when it comes to any As far as even my large, you know, screen that for my computer, which I have at 21 inch, or, you know, a tablet or the iPad or even my phone, I will not watch movies. Not when you can sit there and put it on, you know, a big screen, yeah, like a 40-inch TV, sit on a couch, and kick back and relax. It just, you know, you just lose something, you know.
I completely get it if you're on a train or you're, you know, whatever.
Well, I'll go to bed sometimes. You know, you watch something quick on the tablet. I've got a 20-inch TV in the bedroom, but, you know, it's on the other wall. And I'm lazy.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I just, it's not the thing for me. I don't see it. I don't know. I'm interested in the 7-inch tablets. I could even use a 7-inch phone. Seriously. Cause it's not something I would put up to my ear ever, but you run it off of the Bluetooth headset, right? And then you keep it in your backpack or your pocket or whatever. And you don't ever have to actually look at it. Once you have a device that'll let you do everything, call such and so, do this, do that. You know, I use Vlingo a lot, so I can say, you know, message Steve. Well, no, text Steve, message, blah, 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 send. Right. So I love that. I love the ability to do that, and it's it would be just as easy on a 7-inch tablet or any of those other things. So, yeah, that's I don't know. I'm very interested in the whole idea of the smaller tablet. I'm looking forward to it. All right, we're going to take a quick break. I want to apologize to Linda. I hope she's still holding on. She's a very patient woman. We'll get to her when we come back. But in the meantime, we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, Linda from Greece is on the line, patiently waiting. And we're going to be bringing you just a whole heck of a lot more of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. We're Soundbites. And we're right here on the truly great, member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 24 minutes after the hour, I think Linda from Greece has been patient enough. Welcome, Linda. Thank you for your patience. What's your question?
Hi, gentlemen. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Who walked in?
Nick, I love your article in Computer Link magazine about Vlingo. That is the best thing since sliced bread.
Is it not the coolest thing? I'm very, very impressed with it.
I've got a question for you. In the article, you said you play music. I can't figure out how to get music from my computer to my Android phone. You said you'd do it. How did you do it?
I use a product called AirDroid.
Oh, I don't have a Droid.
You have an Android phone, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what the Droid part means. It doesn't mean specifically a Droid. It means an Android phone.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's fine. Basically, what this is a little program you run. You turn on wireless.
Yeah, I got it.
You start AirDroid.
Now, is that an app on the Android or on your computer?
No, it's on the Android.
Okay, so AirDroid, okay.
Okay, and so what you do is on your phone,
uh-huh,
you turn on wireless, and you start AirDroid.
Right.
It comes up, and it gives you two pieces of information.
Uh-huh.
One is a URL, and it's a number, so it'll be like 192.168.1.50, and then colon 8888. And you put all that in your web browser.
Wait.
On the computer.
Now you lost me.
What it does is it comes up with two pieces of information.
Uh-huh.
One is a series of numbers that ends in colon 8888.
Uh-huh.
On your computer, you open up your web browser. Here's what people are... And you put that in where you would normally put, like, soundbites.org.
In other words, in Mozilla, you'd go to the top.
Right.
Top bar, and under next to www dot, you put that in.
Right, except you erase the www dot.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you have only that number in there, and then you hit enter.
Okay.
It's going to come up and ask you for a password. That password is the second piece of information that AirDroid brings up on your Android phone screen.
Uh-huh.
And it's a little 4-digit password, and it's randomly different every time.
Okay.
You type that in, and what it does now is it brings up on your web browser screen...
Uh-huh.
All the stuff that's on your phone. And it lets you import stuff. It lets you export stuff. It lets you you could send text messages right from your computer through your phone. It does an amazing number of really nifty things. So, for example, whenever I take a bunch of pictures with my phone.
Uh-huh.
I start up AirDroid. I go in through my browser, and then I copy all those pictures to my computer.
So now if I wanted to take something from iTunes, would I have to start up iTunes then?
Well, it doesn't come directly from iTunes. You'd have to have a standard MP3 or any other kind of music file. But once you have a regular MP3 type...
Yeah, you can start up iTunes, and if you right-click on a song, it says Show on Desktop, and
uh-huh.
that shows you that MP3 file that you can then send to the Droid.
Right.
Okay.
So you'd have to say Show on Desktop for every one of the songs you want to move over.
So it'll show up on my desktop then.
Right, then it shows up on your computer desktop.
Okay.
Then in AirDroid, in the web browser on your desktop...
Uh-huh.
One of the folders that's in the browser window is music, and you can open that up,
uh-huh.
and across the top, one of the buttons will say import.
Uh-huh.
So you can then hit that, and then it's just like anything else, you know, it's an open file dialog that, you know, so you go find those music files that you just saved, they'll be on your desktop,
uh-huh.
and you click them, and you import them, and then suddenly... A minute or so later, depending on how fast your Wi-Fi is, they're on your phone.
Yeah, this is a neat way to do it wirelessly. You should also be able to plug a USB cable in between the phone and the computer.
Right.
And then the phone shows up on your computer desktop as a device, and you can copy your songs to it also.
I read an article in my the user's guide for my phone. And, you know... It had connected to plug into the wall, but then I pulled it out and it had a USB cable. And I was reading there where you plug it in. Was that easier?
It's different. It can be easier if you either way works. I just don't usually have that cable handy on me, but AirDroid is always available.
Yeah.
But if that cable is always plugged into your computer anyway, just plug it in and it should show right up on your desktop.
Okay.
You may get a message on your phone. That
yeah.
says, do you want to turn on mass storage or something along that line?
Yeah.
And you say yes, and then it'll show up on your desktop as if it were another drive.
Oh,
and then
yeah.
you can move data back and forth that way.
I tell you, I love Zlingo. I've been showing everybody that. I was in the gym the other day
yep.
at our Rochester Athletic Center, and I was doing something on my phone, and he goes, how'd you do that? And I said, Zlingo. I said, do you have an Android phone? He goes, yeah. And I was showing him what to do. He said, I got to get that.
And it's free.
Yeah, I know. It's great because, you know, my fingers are not as nimble as they used to be.
Right, right, right.
So I sent a text message to my cousin in Massachusetts, and it was great. I didn't have to touch nothing.
Yep. It's great.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah, so yeah, I love that article. So I thought I'd call
Thanks.
You up and ask you about that.
Well, I'm glad you did, and now you have two different ways you could get music onto your Android phone. All righty.
That sounds good. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks, Linda.
Bye.
You could also use one of the cloud services like Google Music or the Amazon Cloud Player has an Android client, doesn't it?
I think it does. Yeah, it does. I do listen to Google Music pretty regularly. I put thousands and thousands and thousands of songs up there. And I listen to that regularly. I listen to Pandora all the time.
I just use the regular radio app on mine.
And I use the radio app regularly as well.
Yeah.
I listen to it. It's become my music device of choice. I thank heavens I still have unlimited data from Verizon. Thank you so much. Because I use it.
You're grandfathered in?
I'm grandfathered in, and I regularly go over my 2-gig limit. I'll tell you what. I regularly go over it. Well,
hey.
I'm using it the way they expect you to use it.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes a lot of data from your data plan. And it amuses me to find that they're all talking about how, oh my God, there's just too many people using all the services we told them they should buy this phone
yeah.
to use. Excuse me? What genius didn't sit down and figure out the data usage of the impact of the data usage of that many people?
Yeah, really. You know, you sit there and provide a product.
Well, you're used to what the data usage was on you know, like a BlackBerry with a tiny screen and that nobody bothered right. going to the web pages on because it was too annoying.
Right, and nobody thought, well, now they're going to be doing YouTube 24/7, uploading YouTube. Speaking of which, here's a news article. AT&T posted a $6.7 billion quarterly loss. $6.7 billion loss in a quarter. As it was weighed down by a hefty breakup fee for its failed T-Mobile USA merger and other big charges on top of costly subsidies for smartphones such as Apple Inc.'s popular iPhone. While the number two U.S. wireless provider beat analyst expectations for subscriber additions, the growth came at a massive cost as its wireless service margins plummeted. On top of the $4 billion breakup package charge, AT&T also took a big impairment charge for its telephone directory business, which it said it was considering selling. Who looks up anything in the phone book anymore? I hate to say that. But who looks up stuff in the phone book anymore?
I love it. I got that one app, you know, Places. It's called Places.
Yeah,
it's an app.
Just put that app on there, and then, you know, whether I want restaurants, gas stations, or whatever, boom. Or Buddy for a gas station.
I think I remember reading that Verizon Telephone has petitioned the FCC to stop printing phone books because nobody uses them.
Who uses them? While advanced devices like iPhones can help subscriber numbers and revenue, it's very hard to make those palm trees for third grade science projects without a phone book.
Yeah.
Although you can do it with newspaper. Not that anybody buys those anymore. While advanced devices like iPhones can help subscriber numbers and revenue, they also shrink earnings as operators like AT&T and its bigger rival Verizon Wireless heavily subsidize the devices to attract customers to two-year contracts. AT&T's wireless service margin fell to 28.7% based on earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, and amortization from 73.7% in the third quarter and 36.6% a year earlier, missing already low analyst expectations. If there's any reason to be upset, it is certainly in the margins, said an analyst who had expected to see margins of 32% instead of 28%. However, he noted that strong smartphone sales should help AT&T in the long run. These are kind of, to me at least, crocodile tears. You know, we've subsidized this phone so you'll take out a two-year contract. And so in the first quarter of your purchase, we lost money. Well, yeah.
Yep.
In his first, but the problem is so many people bought them that it was a huge loss. But you should have expected that. Anyway, in his first presentation to investors, since the December collapse of his $39 billion bid to buy Deutsche Telekom's T-Mobile USA, chief executive for AT&T, Randall Stephenson, spent much of the earnings call criticizing the U.S. Federal Communications Commission for opposing the deal. Stephenson, who argued that AT&T needed the deal to get more wireless spectrum to support increasing demand for wireless data, said he would buy more spectrum once he is clear on the FCC spectrum rules. My interpretation is these rules are so fluid you could drink out of them with a straw right now, he told analysts. That was a celebrity voice. I cannot say that was actually his voice. Roe equity research analyst Kevin Rowe said that only time will tell if the race to sign on smartphone phone customers will be worth the massive drag on margins. It's not getting easier, and it'll be tougher in 2012, he said. The cost to capture and retain customers will increase as competition increases. Are you happy with your smartphone? Give us a call. Linda clearly is. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or, of course, toll-free at 1-800-790-0415. I'll tell you what. I love my Samsung Galaxy Nexus. I absolutely love this phone. It's ridiculously fast, incredibly responsive.
4G, right?
It's 4G. It's unlimited data. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. The folks at Verizon Wireless for grandfathering me in.
I just had to call my daughter this morning.
Yeah?
Because, you know, we're on a family plan.
Oh, yeah.
And my beloved grandson got a notice. He's coming close. This phone number is becoming very close to exceeding their 2-gig limit. Call her up. Well, see what he's doing.
Yeah. Part of the problem is you don't know what the phone is doing. It updates in the background. If you've got 1,000 apps on your phone, that's 1,000 apps that get checked every single day.
Yep.
You know, you may not be using them all, but you downloaded them once because it was cool, and now every one of them checks to be updated every day. And if it does get updated, that could be hundreds of kilobytes.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least maybe half a meg, 2 meg per item. And if you've got 1,000 of those, well, there's your 2 gig.
Yep.
We need to have family data shared plans. For the longest time with cell phones, every cell phone had its own minute plan, and if you know, the husband went over his minutes and the wife had minutes left, it didn't matter. You had to pay more. But then they added shared family minutes. They need to add shared data too. So like on your family plan, your kids get
all of it and you get nothing.
Well, there's that. But you don't have to get 2 gigs, especially if you own a phone, a tablet, and a computer. You got to buy a 2 gig plan for each device.
That makes me so crazy.
That's very annoying.
Well, that's one thing I got to remind my daughter is to make sure that he turns, because they've got wireless Wi-Fi in the house, and my grandson could tap into that instead of using his 2 gig. He just tap into the wireless.
Your devices are supposed to switch automatically
if you've got wireless on.
Yeah.
But wireless drains the battery.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So some people turn that off. What we've been recommending to people is turn your 3G setting off until you know you need to use it. That way it can't use your data until you're ready for it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, I'll tell you what, though. I absolutely love my phone. It's an Android phone, and I love it.
Got
it. I use it more and more for every little thing. What's the weather? What do you want to see at the movies? Yada, yada, yada. Our IT has an app that's nothing but our calendar. Our academic calendar. I immediately downloaded that. There's 10 times a day I have to look up something on that calendar. And now instead of either having to memorize the Rococo way they've done things, I can or having to be at a computer and say, give me a minute, let me find it. Well, yeah, there it is. I can just hit the button on the phone and boom, up it comes and I'm done. It's great.
Well, I was out in Brockport last night and I had to get to Churchville. I'm thinking, oh, I don't want to go back to the expressway. There's got to be another back road.
Straight down 36.
So, well, that's what I found out. 19, yep. I took over Colbert and then right on down. And
You went by my old house. I used to live on 36.
All right. Well, I wound up, you know, just typing in, knew where I was and where I wanted to go. And it said, all right, here you go. Here's a couple different ways. And I went, oh, okay. So sitting there and I got the phone sitting on the dash and it's telling me just like a regular, you know, Garmin and that.
Yep.
I use
that. I have no sense of direction. I get lost in my own driveway. But I can now get anywhere. My wife, on the other hand, can get anywhere just by herself. So the other day we were going somewhere and I had the phone leading us there. And I looked at her and I said, this must be how you feel all the time. And she said, yeah, it actually is. But yeah, it happens. That's my favorite feature because I have no sense of direction. I can't remember how to get anywhere, and that's terrible, but it is what it is.
I like that.
All right. Hold that thought, possibly forever. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 39 minutes after the hour, and for no discernible reason, you continue to listen to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. Give us a call on Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 43 minutes after the hour, 40 degrees, 40 balmy degrees outside.
Get the motorcycle out.
Woo-hoo. It's January 28th.
That is unbelievable.
And it's 40 degrees.
Hey, every day that it doesn't snow, that saves me money.
That's exactly right.
Because I don't have to sit there and put down that calcium chloride
around
the tractor.
This is how you know you become an adult, by the way. When you're not thinking, oh, can't go out and build a fort.
Snow day, we can play.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. No, people are going to track snow and salt into my store, and I'm going to have to vacuum all that up. I was talking with a snowplow guy yesterday, and he's hurting.
Hurting. They're hurting. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah,
I feel bad for all of them. Yep. Absolutely.
The guys who have
contracts.
Yes.
They're sitting pretty, frankly. Yeah. But the guys who get paid by the job, they're hurting.
But.
Have you even read on some of the contract guys? They're thinking of refunding some of the contract money because they don't want to seem...
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
But the thing that is, January, you know, there was a few years ago, it didn't really turn to winter until the third week of January.
Right.
And then it hit. And then February, March. So, I mean, we still got two of the roughest months ahead of us yet, especially February and the beginning of March. I mean, I can remember some really nasty storms come blowing through in February. I think the one in 65?
I can't tell you the number of years as a kid we went to Easter Mass in our winter coats.
Mm-hmm.
So don't tell me that the end of April, the beginning of May, Rochester doesn't get storms.
Oh, well, when was it? It had to be about, I want to say, 7 years ago. I was up to Lake George for Americade. Now, this is the first week in June.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we took off, and it was gorgeous. You know, it's early morning, about 8 o'clock. It's in the upper 50s. We're doing really good, having a great time. Bonsaiing up, we figured we'd go up to Lake Placid.
Yeah. What do they do at Lake Placid? Oh, wait. They had the Winter Olympics there.
We're driving on up there, and it's like we hit this one wall.
Yep.
It went from 55 degrees or better, all of a sudden plummeting down to 30s.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't.
30s, you're still lucky.
We wound up hitting into this one store on our way up there. Luckily, the owners had just taken over, and they had all these sweatshirts that they were trying to get rid of. Just to get rid of, you know, because it was a new name and all that. They were selling them for $5. There was about 12 of us. We all were buying sweatshirts, putting them on.
Yep.
To go, you know, it was unbelievable. And we got up there, and there was, as we come on into Lake Placid, we're seeing snow on the mountains.
Yes, you are. Yes, you are. That's what they do at Lake Placid. They ski. They shush. They luge.
Just looking at some of the webcams from Bristol Mountain here, and I can see grass.
Yeah.
So the ski resorts
are really, really hurting around here. Absolutely true.
Although they do say they have snow and there's trails open.
Well, they made snow, and that's my friends who ski. I no longer have two knees, so I don't. My friends who ski say that artificial snow is tricky.
My partner, Dan, snowboards.
Oh, yeah.
And he's saying, yeah, that snow that they make is kind of, you know, granular. And you can't, as opposed to, you know, fresh snow on that. And
yeah.
He just keeps watching the videos at the shop of these guys snowboarding where they take them up helicopter on top of a mountain.
Oh, yeah.
Drop them off. And you see these insane kids on these snowboards going off these cliffs. And it's like, holy crap. They're going, dropping 30 and 40 feet, and they don't know what they're landing into.
Oh, yes, they do. They've sussed that out pretty good before they go. My favorite is there's a new car commercial where
the truck.
And it actually says...
Yeah, don't try this at home.
Trucks cannot snowboard. Honestly, we have to tell people that. America is now stupider than I thought. Officially stupider than I thought. All right, we're going to go to the phone to a person who's not stupid at all. It's Tom from Irondequoit. Welcome, Tom. What's your question?
Yes, I've taken your advice where I'm working as a user as opposed to an administrator.
Well done, sir.
And they work differently.
Yep.
For instance, if I'm working as a user and I try to print a file, it doesn't go to the printer. My only option is to save it in an extension called .xps.
And then go into your admin and print it there?
I would assume, yeah. I don't know if I... Why can't I access my printer?
Do you not see the printer, or do you see it but can't use it?
When I go to the, you know, file, print,
mm-hmm.
It says the only option is to save it to an XPS file.
All right. What you have to do is, as a user...
Okay.
Excuse me. As the administrator,
okay.
You have to share the printer.
Okay.
If you've locked the printer down, and generally speaking, that's the way it works now. Are you in Windows 7?
No, I'm still in XP.
Huh? Wow. But at any rate, you should be able to just share the printer out. And generally speaking, sharing it on your local network is not really a problem. I'm assuming you've got some sort of router connecting you to cable or to DSL.
Just DSL.
It's the printer permissions tab.
Right.
So printer permissions tab.
So as the administrator, I'll post this link too.
Okay.
As the administrator, get properties on your print queue.
Okay.
And there's a printer permission tab. It's probably set to administrators only.
Yep.
You have to add all users as a permission to use that printer.
And I think you need to add guests. Otherwise, it will always... And you may not mind this. But it might ask you for your password.
Okay.
Now, everyone is one of the groups you can add.
Yeah, everyone.
Okay.
That's the one. That's
what it is. Another thing, like when I recently downloaded Google Chrome.
Yeah.
To use that, I had to do it as an administrator, but now I can't access it when I'm working as a user.
Same thing. You should be able to right click on it, Generally, when you install it.
Okay.
Wait a minute, Google Chrome.
Yeah, when you install it, it should ask if you want to do this user or all users.
Chrome does weird things, and you may need to install it as the user. Chrome actually, I believe, will let you install it as the user because it doesn't do anything to the registry. So it may not be shareable as such. In other words, if you save something to your bookmarks as the admin, you don't see them as the user because you're two different people.
Right. Each user has their own separate bookmarks and their own separate settings. So I found a question for Windows 7. Install Chrome as that user.
Yeah.
And then that user should have option.
So I'd have to reinstall it?
Yes. Install it as the user. It's one of the few programs that doesn't touch the registry, so any user can install it, and any user can manage it his or herself.
A lot of programs ask you when you're installing, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you want it to be this user or every user? However, I don't know that Chrome asks that because every user is separate.
Yeah, I don't recall that being asked.
Yeah.
So is there any way to use it then? Is it when I'm in the user file or?
No, just reinstall it.
Okay. And then go under all users.
Yep.
Okay.
Well, or it might show up under your stuff, but it should put an icon on the desktop anyway, so.
Okay. And then on that sharing the printer.
Yeah.
For that properties or the print queue. Yep. That's accessed through what, the control panel?
Right, control panel, and then printers, and then right-click on the print queue.
Okay. I appreciate your help.
Thank you.
You guys are great. Thanks.
Have fun.
Well, we got him fooled.
Yeah, exactly. There are some differences to not running as administrator. You have to be a little more careful how you install things. You do have to share some stuff. But really, the tiny, tiny, tiny bit of inconvenience that you go through once or twice in the long run is way worth it in terms of security.
Well, especially right now. I mean, there's a couple rootkits out there that are totally... Boy, this thing just wants to be as tall as Rob. Or either that or as short as...
Well, it's those brass springs that somebody put on there.
I guess.
Yeah.
The thing keeps wanting to pop up.
Yeah, we've still got the crappy pot metal springs. You've got the nice brass springs on yours. Big deal.
I didn't do it. Talk to the boss. He's the one that ordered it for, this area. I mean, because most of the DJs are here.
That's where he stands, exactly.
And again, it's adjusted for, 7 foot. I'm only 5'9", and it's like, all right.
What's poor Linda do?
She's got the step stool.
Of course.
But where was I going? Speaking of which, here's Linda now.
Linda does have the evil eye look down quite completely, I'll tell you that right now. We love you, Linda.
See? Nothing but love around this studio.
If I can feel the love.
Yes, all the way around. But no, there are a few rootkits out there right now that are getting into it, and the only alternative we found so far is literally backing up the data, wiping the machine, and doing a reinstall.
Well, I've been talking to people a lot about the Security Tango, and I keep telling them it can't yet do rootkits, although we are working on it.
Yeah, it's
but it's a real problem in terms of that, because you can't. Really, the only way to kill a rootkit is outside the operating system itself.
Right. We pull it out. We pull the machine, the hard drive out of the machine, put it on our bench, remove the small portion of it.
Yep.
Then we have to take it back into the machine and do other further isolation of it to get rid of the rest. And it's a long process. Matter of fact, I had one machine come in, and we did a lot of cleanup, but now all of a sudden their DVD player is disappearing. And Windows keeps saying it. I tried to do a repair, but that's not working. And the folks are a little upset. Well, why wasn't this? Sorry, but when we correct one issue, it can destroy other things. We don't go through and check every program and everything else.
That would just take too long, and you wouldn't want to pay for that.
Exactly. Right. We'd have to charge for it. So, I am trying to cut her somewhat of a deal, but, some of the stuff we just have no control over, and like Steve was just saying, it would just take us too long to check it all out.
Yep.
And, you know,
we've got a PC in the shop this week that's got a turned out to be a malware, something called System Check.
Mm-hmm.
A window popped up and said, "What is it? Your system RAM is corrupted. Bad blocks on the hard drive, and what was the other one? Or three or four error messages like that." And so, you know, I'm thinking, all right, sounds like a bad hard drive. So I ran SpinRite on it. SpinRite says perfectly fine. So I start Googling around. It's a rogue program. It's like the fake antivirus programs mm-hmm. that want you to buy. This is a fake repair program.
Huh?
And it disabled network access, so I can't download the tools on it. So it's mm-hmm. it's a pain.
Oh man, let's talk about network access. I could not. We have a Mac Mini server at work. It would not talk to the network. Both wired and wirelessly, it was getting a self-assigned IP address.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked all over the net and found just simply nothing. I turned off the firewall. Somebody said, get rid of passive FTP. What? Okay, I'll try it. At that point, I was so desperate. I did every single thing. I killed the entire preferences folder, figuring if it kills the machine, I don't care. At this point, I can't use it anyway. I did every single thing I could. And finally, I just went into the terminal and flushed the firewall. Now, according to the Finder, the firewall was off. And I had rebooted multiple times since I turned the firewall off a week ago. And it still says the firewall is off. However, until I flushed the firewall, it apparently was still working. Simply turning it off doesn't actually mean you've turned it off. Apparently, I don't know what that means to the Macintosh people, but it doesn't actually turn off the firewall. I had to go in and flush it, and then everything came back. What the hell does it mean that when you turn off the firewall then? Yeah. I need an answer from somebody at Apple. What does it mean to turn off the firewall when, in fact, it simply does not turn off the firewall?
And
it may
I
have
love the
been
term
that,
flush.
Yeah, it may have been that you turned it off in the GUI and there was something. Well, you deleted your
I
preference file.
I rebooted multiple times.
But when you turn it off in the GUI, it didn't turn it off at the Unix layer, which the GUI is just a look.
No,
at.
I do understand that, but yeah. I rebooted multiple times. It still said it was off. I got rid of all my preferences. Yep. It still said it was off.
Force flush.
And apparently, it wasn't off. So IPFW-flush. Yep. Kills all of the stuff that's in the firewall and lets it restart again and rebuild. And that's when everything came back. And it just angered me. I'm sorry, but don't have a feature that doesn't work. I could have solved my problem a month ago because I thought I had turned the firewall off. Mm-hmm. You know, I had done every single thing I could think to do.
But, okay, but why would the firewall block DHCP?
That's the other thing. Yeah. Absolutely. But I went in and flushed the firewall. I took a look at all the rules, and it had one that said block everything.
Block all incoming, yeah.
And I thought, what? What the hell kind of firewall rule is that? So I got rid of everything in the firewall, and it's back again. I don't even know how that came out, where that came from. It hasn't come back, so I don't think it was a virus of any sort. It just was clearly a glitch somewhere.
Did you try a manual IP?
Yes.
And that,
our network doesn't like that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, our network at work does not like that. So so it killed it. But yeah.
It's block all except DHCP.
Yeah, see,
is what it should do. Yeah.
Yeah, but I tried all those things and all that was off in the GUI. Simply do not trust the GUI. Apparently is the lesson to be learned here. Listen, we're going to take a break. We'll be back. Actually, it's going to be kind of a longish break because now I have to. It was my Uncle Nick mini rant, I think. We're going to be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, with Steve Ray, with me, Nick Francesco, and you. Listen, you need to give us a call. You know you need to give us a call, and it's awfully easy to do. The number is 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Of course, you can call us toll-free at 1-800-790-0415. If we're on the air, give us a second to answer the phone. It'll be a bit, but we'll get there. And we'd love to hear from you as we come back for a whole nother hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. We are Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 3 minutes after the hour, We have our friend Dar from the frozen north with us on the phone. Welcome, Dar. How are you? Dar? Oh, hold on.
I don't make sure Dave pushes all the buttons right.
Dar, are you there? Apparently, it's way too frozen up there in the north.
No, I got to do some adjustments. It looks like this thing bonked out.
All right, Dar, do us a favor, please, and give us a couple of minutes, and we'll see if we can get you back again. Dave's going to be, I think he's going to perform percussive maintenance on one of the units here. And that means
yank the cord. Make sure you yank the right cord when you go back there.
Take a hammer to it. Exactly. Exactly. We're firm believers in percussive maintenance here. If it doesn't work, you're not using a big enough hammer. This is one of the reasons I like actually the new aluminum cases on Macintosh devices, because you can see where you put the dents.
Yeah,
it's very nice actually. That's pretty cool. Plastic just cracks everywhere, and it's hard to know. Are you trying to get Dar back? Excellent. Thank you for your patience, Dar. It's we're going to give it another try. Here's Dave pushing four buttons, five buttons, six buttons, and a slider. Are you there? Nope.
Maybe not.
Maybe not. All right. I don't know what to tell you at this point, Dar. We're clearly having trouble with the device. And not sure how to handle that. Dave is working on that. In the meantime, I will read another news item. Actually, there's two things I want to talk about. But first, we'll talk about Jim Balsillie. That's what it says. And Mike Lazaridis, who made the BlackBerry a leading business tool but then presided over its precipitous decline, said they would step down Monday as co-chairman and co-chief executives of Research in Motion. The two men, in developing the innovative device that was the first to reliably deliver email over airwaves, turned a tiny Canadian company into a global electronics giant, but they are stepping aside after disappointing investors and leaving customers wondering whether RIM still has the ability to compete and perhaps even survive in the rapidly changing markets for smartphones and tablet computers. Stiff competition from Apple iPhone and phones using Google's Android software dramatically eroded RIM's share in the North American market to about 9%. In the third quarter of 2011, from nearly half the market 2 years earlier. The company's stock price reflected that by dropping about 75% in the last year. But while Mr. Balsillie and Mr. Lazaridis, who had become the targets of some disgruntled shareholders, are stepping aside, investors and others looking for changes in the company's strategy may be disappointed. The company named Thorsten Hines, currently one of RIM's two chief operating officers, as the chief executive. He pledged during an interview on Sunday to follow the strategy Mr. Balsillie and Mr. Lazaridis set in place.
And isn't that the problem? The strategy they put in place isn't working?
Strategy.
And they had co-CEOs and co-COOs?
Yeah, exactly. they had two of each and still got where they are. RIM had a lot of other problems, including their playbook tablet computer, which lacked crucial features like everything. Including email. It is now being sold at prices below RIM's manufacturing costs. So our question to you, do you have a BlackBerry and are you still happy with it? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free at 1-800-790-0415. Just like we're hoping Dar did, all the way from the frozen north. Are you there, Dar?
Yep.
Yay! Well done. Well done, Dave.
The Great White North firewall is down.
That's right. That's you guys. You guys are our RIM. It's a Canadian company, and it owned half the market in its day.
Okay. Question about Windows 8.
Yes.
So now we're going to have a hardware firewall from Microsoft with the ARM race.
Yep, they will be selling one of those.
Mm-hmm.
So that means Linux guys, unless they're really geeky, are SOL.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. They're making it so that there's a built-in boot thing that will then have to, I guess, authenticate your operating system. And if it's not Windows, you can't have it. And if they get that into enough products, Linux people will be SOL. That's exactly right. I'm a little surprised that the at the hardware manufacturers agreeing to this. Of course, I guess if you throw enough money at anybody, the question, as Winston Churchill once said, we already know what you are. We're just negotiating price.
Well, it's like alternative med versus big pharma.
Right.
Vitamin C cures everything under the sun.
Yep.
But it isn't patented.
Right. So, yeah, you shouldn't be taking it because it's not patented.
Yeah.
No, I get it. You're absolutely right. We'll see what the deal is with that. It's a pre-boot. It's part of the BIOS, actually. Yep. And what it'll do is it'll verify. And the guys, they're putting it under the guise of making sure that your system hasn't been tampered with. Isn't that sweet? So what that means is if you do get a rootkit virus, your system won't even boot. If you replace the hard drive, your system won't even boot. If you try to run a different operating system, your system won't even boot. What happens when Windows 9 comes out and you've still got the same hardware? I suspect it won't even boot.
So it's a disposable operating system.
Isn't that great for them?
Oh, beautiful.
Yep, yeah. It's beautiful for Windows, and it's beautiful for Microsoft, and it's beautiful for the folks who make the hardware. So what'll be interesting to see if there's anybody who still makes regular old everyday hardware that the rest of us can use.
Well,
if that actually becomes a significant piece of the market.
Or if it can be turned off, because we had the virus check in BIOS that gets turned off because it's out of date instantly.
Yeah. Windows
and,
Defender.
And the TPM in BIOS that can currently still get turned off. The trusted platform module, so that was one of the first things that Intel and Microsoft tried to do for copy protection issues.
Right, so if it can be turned off, we're in good shape. And if not, we're just going to have to be much more careful what hardware we buy.
Well, the whole thing is, well, it's either one a rock or a hard place.
Exactly. I know, I completely understand. And on the third hand, if you will, how many people are still buying hardware?
And the gripping hand.
The gripping hand. How many people are still buying desktops and laptops anyway, as we've already heard twice today? Laptops and desktop sales are dropping precipitously, and it's all going to tablets anyway.
I think you'll see desktops still be around, laptops still gone.
That's very possible.
Cloud computing.
We were talking about this with a customer the other day, that 20 years ago, people ended up buying a desktop and a laptop. You needed the desktop power and the laptop portability. And for the last 5 years or so, laptops have pretty much been outselling desktops up to 2-to-1
mm-hmm.
because the laptops have gotten powerful enough mm-hmm. that they're okay to use all the time.
Do World of Warcraft.
Right. Even. Now we're starting to see a big desktop, because desktops are still more powerful than laptops. You get a desktop and a tablet.
And cheaper, by the way.
Right. And we were looking at with a customer the other day. We can get a 21-inch iMac and an iPad for the same price as a 15-inch laptop.
Yep.
So you end up with two devices, one for the husband, one for the wife.
Well, all right.
But then you get that big desktop and something light and portable.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
See, it's cyclical. It goes back to the mainframe in the basement that everyone had to walk up to and hand punch cards to it. And then we had terminals on your desk. And then we got PCs that were that brought your power back locally. Then we got file servers, which sort of spread it out a little more. And then we've got cloud that spread it out a little more. And now we're almost back to the mainframe in the basement with terminals on top.
Yeah.
Yep. And for those of us who are living mostly in the cloud, a Chromebook is really all I need for 90% of what I do. And that will link me into the cloud, and that will link me to my Android phone and tablet. And so I have everything right where I need it, exactly as I need it. And it works pretty nicely. But you're right, Dar. We've gone a little far afield from the Windows 8 thing. But you're right. That's going to be a problem for those of us who want to buy unencumbered hardware and put our own software on it.
Okay, cheers.
Thanks. Fun, Dar.
Later.
Thank you.
Maybe there'll be another revolt like the Linux people staged a few years ago. Microsoft's license with most PC manufacturers meant they had to pay for Windows on every computer, even if they didn't put it on that computer.
Right.
So people that bought a new PC with Windows but wanted to run Linux on it, marched up to Redmond and said they wanted the money back for Windows that they're not going to use.
Well, and that was part of the contract.
Yep.
You if you weren't going to use it and you returned it unopened.
Which was part of the Department of Justice settlement when they declared Microsoft was an illegal monopoly for doing just things just like that.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so a whole bunch of people went up to Microsoft and said, hey, we want our money back. Here's, you know, it was $8 or something. It's really all you got back.
Which is ridiculous because Windows is $200 to buy it new.
That's absolutely right. But apparently it's only worth, Microsoft believes it's only worth $8.
Yeah.
Well, it's just like they stopped them also for preloading all that extra junk on a lot of those machines, you know, and this and that. Getting people ticked off because, you know.
That did help lower the cost of the computer, but because all of that stuff that got put on there was paid for by those vendors.
Yeah. Yep.
But, yeah, for the end user, it was a mess.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so you were being charged $200. Let's say it actually cost $200.
Yeah.
Let's say it cost $200. At least $200 of that was offset by what the manufacturers of the bloatware were putting in your machine. You were paying $200. Essentially, Microsoft was getting paid twice.
Mm-hmm. Double dipping.
To put your operating system on your machine. Nice work if you can get it.
Yep.
Talking about putting stuff in the cloud, as we were early this week, Google changed their privacy policy. And that change has caught the attention of an independent watchdog from the federal cloud that's really worried about the security risk for government users. A group called SafeGov disputes the Google's claims that the changes won't affect government workers. Well, the basic changes to its privacy policy, they announced them on Tuesday, says they're aimed at simplifying. Part of that simplification includes sharing its users' data across all its services so it can tailor the delivery of those services and unite them better. So if you use Picasa and Google Docs and Google Plus and Google's
music.
Contact list and music and everything else. No. Those it'll share across all the. You essentially have one unified identity. When you log in as one person to all of these features. It's like buying an office suite.
Yeah.
You know, you buy a suite of products, and you only log into them, so to speak, once. And now, Google is saying we're going to do that with all of our stuff as well. When you want to buy music or use Google Wallet or go into Google Docs or whatever it is you're going to do, we're going to combine all the information we gather into one thing. Now, the real question, of course, becomes what do they gather?
Well, I like the way they're saying it. If you go to Google.com homepage, we're changing our privacy and policy and terms, not the usual yada yada.
Right.
So they're trying to make it simpler and cleaner. We will take everything, period. And also, the Google Doodle today, I didn't know it was the 125th anniversary of the largest snowflake.
Yeah, it is. Tomorrow is W.C. Fields' 132nd birthday. But this week, the basic privacy settings, the company will collect and compile data about its users based on their activity, not by your name, not any of that nonsense they say, but by your activity, from the search page to Gmail to YouTube to what's going on your phone to pretty much everything. And that has given some privacy advocates cause for alarm, although Google says the information is assembled really to enhance the user experience, better targeting ads that will be of interest to the customers and stuff like that. Eight members of Congress have written a letter to Larry Page, the CEO of Google, asking for clarification about the changes. We don't know what any of this means yet. The government is asking Google to share what kind of data it currently collects and explains how the information collected under the newly announced system will be used. There have been misconceptions about changes, according to Google's Betsy Masiello. A lot of what's been said about the new privacy policy, some have praised this for making privacy policy easier to understand. Others have asked questions, including members of Congress, and that's understandable, too. Masiello makes a bunch of points in the post, which is that users don't have to be logged in now to use many of Google's products, including search and YouTube. No data are collected when a user is not logged in. That's pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm.
When you are logged in, you can edit or turn off your search histories. Switch Gmail chat to off the record. Use incognito mode on the Google Chrome browser. Employ any of Google's other privacy tools, of which there is a plethora. Quite simply, web users don't have to use all of Google's products. And that's the other part of it. If you don't want to use their products, you don't have to. Nobody's holding a gun to your head. And that's according to her. And she noted that Google actually isn't going to be collecting any extra data. There's no more data than they were collecting before.
Mm-hmm.
They're just coordinating it better and being upfront about it to be transparent in what they're doing. And that's what they're doing.
One thing I noticed, though, that Google just changed, or maybe it's been changed for a little bit, was, you know, on their maps.
Yeah.
If you want to print off a map, I haven't been able to find the function. It just says, just print the map. It wants to either print part of the text with the directions.
Mm-hmm. Or both.
Or it just can't print just the map. If I just want just the map, no directions or anything else. Nope, it won't let me do it.
I don't know.
You must have a setting turned on because I just tried to print a map and all I got was the map.
There you go. It's got to be a setting that you turned off somewhere.
Hmm.
All right, we're going to go back to the phones while
no, maybe not.
No, apparently you're not. That's interesting.
Well, back to RIM for a second. Did you see the Joy Attack with the RIM cartoon?
No.
The two CEOs, we've stepped down. I hope you're all happy now. You won't have us to kick around anymore. And then one guy says, don't worry, we'll still be on the board and we'll give guidance and direction. And the other guy says, you weren't supposed to remind him of that.
All right, Jim from Greece is back on the line, or not.
Yeah, he should be back. Jim?
Are you there?
I'm actually here.
There you go. Welcome, Jim. What's your question?
Okay, couple questions. So I need to upgrade because I'm dealing with a lot of very large images. I'm a photographer.
Yeah.
And some of the images nowadays, you know, coming out of 24 megapixel cameras and whatnot are up to 100 megabytes in size. So I need something powerful. And right now I'm kind of looking at a tower, like a Windows tower, the latest generation of i7 core, whatever the heck it is. But the question really is, if I'm going to be manipulating images mainly in Photoshop and other similar programs, and I want speed and performance, should I go Mac or PC?
I knew you were going to be asking that question, and we're not going to tell you that until after the break. So stay on the line, Jim. We're a little late taking our break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, Jim from Greece, answering his burning question. And a whole lot more of Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
The thing is he put the wrong one in.
Right, this is not Thursday.
Nope. My show is live on Thursdays, but he clearly didn't put the right one in because I did do two liners. One that says for Thursday night and then join me Thursday nights.
Right.
Oh, well.
All right, we're back with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco. It's Soundbites, and Jim from Greece is on the line. And he wants to know the eternal question, PC
or Mac?
Or Mac? Steve?
Can I add one caveat?
Of course.
Yeah, the caveat is that I'm a little more PC friendly in terms of my knowledge of the operating system, and because I use it all day at work. So basically, you guys have to save me from jumping off a cliff and buying a PC.
Well, I'll tell you what.
Talk me out of it, please. But I'd rather just have the true answer as far as what would be the better thing for speed and performance.
Well, it depends on how you define better. Of course.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
It's six. You know what? It doesn't matter.
Okay.
The reality is, depending on how much money you spend, you can get as much power and speed and storage as you want on either side. If what you're mostly using is Photoshop, it's the same product on both platforms.
Although we hear from people that do use it on both platforms that the Mac version works better. We don't know why. We can't quantify it, but it feels better. It feels better. It was designed to work on the Mac to begin with and later ported to Windows.
Right. Mm-hmm. But really, honestly, it's six of one, half a dozen of the other.
Yep.
You'll spend less money for the same hardware in Windows, all other things being equal. But by the time you build up a PC to what you might get on a high-end Mac to begin with, you're awful close in price anyway. It really comes down to two factors. What are you more comfortable with, and how's your warranty?
Yeah. Right now I'm more comfortable with the PC.
Then buy a PC.
Yeah.
I mean, Steve has loyalty to PC. Dave has to Macs. Dave has loyalty to Windows. I could care less about either one. But all three of us will say exactly the same thing, which is in the long run, get what you're comfortable with.
And where, especially.
But there's nothing wrong with learning something new.
Yeah, but no, but what I'm saying, no.
And that becomes the danger, because we see this a lot with people upgrading their programs. They don't, even with Photoshop, CS 5.5 is the current version that if I upgrade, I'm not going to know it as much, so I won't be as productive for the first few weeks, so they never bother upgrading.
Right.
But if it's work, it's PC.
One of those people.
Yeah.
Well, but, Jim,
I'm still running CS2 on one of my machines, and you know what? It does everything I need. I don't want to upgrade to CS5 because it seems like Microsoft is famous for this. Just move some things around and make it look like a new interface while totally confusing me at the same time.
Right.
And that, what is it that's new and better about it other than the fact that you need, as a company, to sell more product?
And the problem you're going to run into is if you buy a new computer, Mac or PC, you can't buy CS2 anymore, so you're going to have to buy CS5, and it's going to be different.
Yeah, well, at least I can upgrade. I can do an upgrade, but I actually have a Power PC.
No, you can't. Can you? Yeah, I think you can upgrade from 2 to 5. Adobe got in real trouble on the internet a couple of weeks ago. They were announcing their CS6 upgrade policy.
Uh-huh.
Generally speaking, they only let you upgrade from 2 versions old. So that would be from 4 to 6.
Yeah.
And all the millions of people that are still using 2 and 3 were outraged, and they said, oh, "Okay, you can go from 3 then."
Right. I actually have a hand-me-down Power PC Mac G5. But it's just not fast enough for my purposes, and it's running Mac OS 10.4, and I like having a Mac, but it's just like the hardware just isn't fast enough.
That's a 6 or 7 year old computer. It's equivalent to a Pentium 5, and it was a great computer back then. But now with the i7s and the quad cores,
right? Now, according to the doctor on the IRC chat, CS5 does HDR better. You don't have to get an external program. CS5 was a major upgrade.
Yeah.
So if you're and it sounds like you're doing HDR, right?
Yeah, I'm really that's pretty much all I'm doing these days. And I'm using Photomatics for that. I'm kind of into Photomatics and I like it. So I don't really necessarily need CS5 for that. But the other question that I have for you guys is what of my old PC software will still run on Windows 7, for example.
There's no way to know for sure. You've got to go to the manufacturer, everybody's website, and look at compatibility issues.
And when you say old PC software, how old?
Some
versions will run, some won't. We don't have them all in our heads.
Right, and some of them you can sit there and load them. Maybe they might not work initially under the Windows 7 platform, but on a lot of them you can go right click on the icon and go into compatibility
mode.
If
you buy the higher end of Windows 7 that has the XP compatibility mode in it.
Yep.
Okay.
And you can sit there and have it go into a different compatibility mode.
If it has the if that's kind of like a virtual machine, the XP compatibility mode,
sort of, but not really.
Slow it way down.
It depends. It depends on the software.
Well, it depends on a whole lot of things.
Yeah.
It depends on how much RAM you have.
Yeah.
It depends on how much you've given to the virtual machine.
Right.
Depends on how many other things you've got running.
Yeah.
I mean, at work we have one machine that's got 8 gig of RAM and a quad core processor, and it runs nothing but virtual Windows XP environments, and they're hella fast, but we only run 3 of them,
right?
And so they each get 2 gig each, and they're running specialized software that we have to run, and that just never got upgraded by the manufacturer,
right?
And so that works fine for what we want it to do, But we're not asking it to do high-end graphics. We're not, there's just a whole bunch of stuff we're not asking it to do.
Yeah. Well, one of the things is Microsoft Front Page 2003. And Windows pulled out support for that product. They no longer offer it. They no longer support it. But there's this user base out there that has years of experience using it, including me. And I'm fine with it. I'm comfortable with it. Everything on my site has Microsoft Front Page user extensions. So if I go to another program, I've got to redevelop everything. Yep. That's another thing that these manufacturers do that really torques me off.
And Front Page was notorious for making really crappy code and really slow websites. One of the reasons they abandoned it.
Well, I use as close to basic HTML as I possibly can. Again, most of it has to do with I'm used to the interface.
Yeah.
You use Front Page code for forms and things like that. The photo gallery features some of the web components that they have. And it still seems to be pretty light.
Yeah, Nick does all his websites in a text editor.
I do. But you might also want to take a look at a product called Enview, N-V-U.
Okay.
And that's at nview.com, actually.
Okay.
At least it used to be. Are they gone?
Net2.com, I find.
Yeah, I need simple. I need easy. And the problem with Microsoft Front Page is sooner or later, very few web hosting companies are going to be offering web front page hosting anymore.
And that's exactly right. But at least particularly now while you've got the time before you're forced into it, take a look at Enview. It's essentially free.
Okay.
Essentially free. It's a free product. You can host it on. They have a $5 a month hosting thing that they do, and you can just the software itself is free, and you can obviously host somewhere else if you want to. It might take a little while to learn, but I do most of my stuff by hand. But I know lots and lots of people who have used Enview for the longest time and really like it. It's got a kind of a semi-WYSIWYG, I'd have to call it, thing. And check out their website. It's at net2.com/Enview.
I will do that. Based on your advice, I'll definitely take a look at it.
Well, I'm not saying it's, definitely get it, but what the heck? It's free.
Yeah.
Download it and give it a try. And if it's not for you, well, you've lost maybe an hour of time and no money.
Right.
I don't know how you beat that.
Yep, exactly.
All right.
All right, guys. Thank you very much.
Sure. Steve is right. I do all my stuff in my in a text editor. I write it all by hand. But Enview is pretty slick. The last time I used it had all kinds of pull downs for forms and other things like that. So you could do a bunch of stuff pretty easily, pretty nicely. I think there's a version for everybody.
Pretty much everything. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know that there's a website you can't. Get it. An operating system.
Windows, Mac, and Linux.
Yeah, yeah. Windows, Mac, Linux. And then there's a couple of because it's free software. It's both open source and free. There's a Composer and Blue Griffin, which are branches of the same thing, and they're also apparently available for dang near everything. So
it is only 32-bit.
It is only 32-bit, I think. I think that's true. All right, we're going on to our next call. That's Gil from Fairport, New York. Welcome, Gil. What's your question?
Hi, guys. Formerly from Webster.
And you've moved to Fairport now?
We have moved to sunny, bright, and no longer the where life is worth living, I guess. I don't know. But
is life not worth living in Fairport?
Things are fine in Fairport.
Things are fine in Fairport.
And alliteration lives on. So here you go. So I had actually a comment and a question. My question is due primarily to you, Nick. I have adopted Ubuntu as my email and browsing machine.
Well done, you.
Well, it's your fault. So in any event, all blame aside, it's really working wonderfully. And I think it's a really nice virus solution in the sense that I keep nothing on that machine other than what I browse and, so forth and so on. So they have to get through that to my Windows machine in order to, make things happen. But
It makes things so much freer, doesn't it?
It does. I feel liberated, but that's really the crux of my question, which is that sometimes, on some days, I get something good on my Ubuntu machine, and I want to put it on my Windows machine. And I use Samba.
Yep.
Depending on which way you're facing, I guess.
Exactly.
And sometimes it used to work. And lately, it's been getting more and more frustrating, let's say, to make it actually connect to my Windows machine. And I'm running, my Windows machine is an XP with all the service packs and so forth. And, you know, sometimes it will connect, sometimes it won't connect. And what I'm looking for is, do you have any little pointers as to, you know, how to get it to be a little bit more friendly to my Windows machine? And then I have a comment about something Steve said.
All right. Well, do you get any sort of error messages?
Yeah, I get basically the lookup. It did not find, you know, the name of my machine.
Which version of Ubuntu are you running?
Oh, boy, something fairly new. You would ask me something ridiculous like that. But it's a fairly new version. It's not one of the stablest versions, but, you know, I keep using kind of the newest one, and it's right up to date, so.
So in the error messages, you have trouble connecting?
It's not that I have trouble connecting. It just does not find the machine that I ask for, which is, you know, the name of my Windows machine.
Yeah, are you going by name or by address?
Well, I go by name, and I've tried to go by address, and I typed in what appears to be its IP address, and that didn't seem to, you know, make it any smoother. In fact, lately it's been completely refusing any connection whatsoever, and I can't tell whether that's a
That sounds like a network issue.
Well, I'm going right back to the firewall, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah, you could have your firewall. Try the firewall turned on, blocking file sharing.
Okay. Well,
try a ping
at
a command line.
So would Windows firewall be the... I mean, that's the kind of pointer I'm looking for.
Yeah, I would start, frankly, with the Windows firewall.
Okay.
Just for the heck of it, turn off the firewall entirely and see if that works.
Yep. Okay.
If it does, then there's a problem, and we can go from there. If it doesn't, well, we'll talk about that when we come back.
Okay.
Good timing, eh? We're going to take a break, back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, Gil from Fairport is on the line, and you. It is the longest-running computer show in the known universe. We take questions from anybody about anything, including Samba, and we'll be back in a whole lot more soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Hi, this is Nick Francesco. Welcome back. Go ahead.
I'm Dave.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 43 minutes, I lied to you, it's 44 minutes after the hour. We are soundbites. We are still talking to Gil from Fairport, who wants to know about XP. I would turn off the XP firewall. I would also turn off, by the way, the Ubuntu firewall, and see if either of those helps. And that's the place I'd start. There's also an article that Steve is going to put online, and it's a troubleshooting guide to connecting Samba to an XP system. And you should follow through those steps.
I'd even start lower with a command prompt and try a ping. There may be something
lower. Start with a ping and see if you can get there at all.
Yeah, I did that. I think the problem is what I was looking for is there any conceptual reason why the lookup of my machine by name would fail?
Oh, sure. Lookup by name fails quite frequently.
It seems to.
Usually there was a concept in Windows called the master browser. And then the domain controller publishes the names of devices. And theoretically, when you don't have a domain controller, every device publishes its own name. Doesn't always work very well.
Right. And in addition, if both your Windows machine and your Ubuntu machine think they are the master browser, There's a little problem.
Which is why IP address should always work.
You should always, where you can, you should always use the IP address.
Always family problems, I guess. What can you do?
Exactly.
Okay, well, that gives me a place to start. I did have a comment to sort of throw up in the air. It was related to the last caller and comment that Steve made, which was, it never hurts to learn something. I guess in some cases I would take some issue with that because with the vastness of Windows, the vastness of Ubuntu, and the vastness of many, many pieces of software, especially when it comes down to these things, the graphics kinds of software that has a very long learning curve. I guess what I would personally say is I would recommend going slowly and make sure you choose one, because if you really want to use it and you really want to sort of get in there and find out whether you want to use it, oftentimes it takes a huge investment of time to spin up to the point where you can even tell whether you like it. Now, some things are very hard to get off the ground with, but once you get there, you just couldn't live without it. And, other things you can say right away, oh, this looks really good, and then you find out, yeah, but that it was all, surface fluff and whatever else.
Yeah, I completely agree. That's why when I'm, when I talk about something like EnView, spend an hour, spend a couple hours, see if you feel, when you buy a new program, the best thing to do is see if you feel that learning it is worthwhile to you, right? As opposed to learning it right away, take a look at what it can do, read the documentation, play around with it a little bit, see if what it does and the way it does it makes enough sense to you to then invest the time to go in and learn it.
Especially with what I heard the last caller say was that, this is, at one point he said, I think I'm quoting him, this is about all I do nowadays, blah, blah, blah. And the point of the matter is, if that's really true, if that's a bulk of the portion of his, computer usage time, let that drive what he picks. Pick the best doggone thing that, and then he can afford to invest the effort to learn the best thing for that particular usage and, almost to the exclusion of...
Well, and the main reason that I suggested EnView is because you simply can't get front page anymore.
Right, and that was one of my points, is that he's using 10-year-old web authoring software and 10-year-old photo editing software.
Yeah, there have been huge... almost the latest stuff, right?
Right, well, there have been huge changes in the last 10 years, so he's going to have a much steeper learning curve than if he'd upgraded along the way, maybe every other version or something.
Sure.
So that becomes a danger that eventually, even though, all I do is web authoring, well, you're using such old software that nobody's going to support it anymore. So now you're going to be out of business unless you're forced to adapt.
On the other hand, it may be a real advantage to him in the sense that he can...
Yeah, the only one left to edit old sites.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, he can't afford not to.
There you go.
I mean, he has
There's
to
a lot of people making money in Access 2000 because there's so many databases. Yeah.
No, but you're absolutely right, Gil. You're absolutely right. He's now forced to make the leap that he wasn't forced to make before, so he might as well just do it.
Right. But the only point, I guess, to repeat the point, which is that when he leaps, I mean, this is a big cliff. You're jumping off right into the abyss. Pick very, very carefully because, you only get to make this kind of an investment in the time it takes to learn a new system, especially, to catch up for 10 years worth of, learning. So when you jump off that cliff, make sure that you jump on the right side. If you jump into the ocean, well, I hope you can swim, but, you want to jump to something that's going to last you for maybe another 10 years, something like that.
Yeah, I have a faculty member who I'm teaching a new piece of software to, and he's very frustrated because he's very facile with the software he's got, and so learning this new software is tough for him. And I keep reminding him it's like learning to drive. It took a few weeks, but now you don't care anymore. You just get in the car, turn the key, and go. You don't think about it. But there were the days when you had to think, which one is the accelerator? Which one is drive? So you have to do all. Listen, we got to go.
Okay,
we got another call. Thanks.
Well, one quick point I wanted to make that now just escaped me. Computers are a completely different field than other things. Woodworking You know, you spend 10 years mastering woodworking, you're still going to be a master woodworker. Right. But in the computer world, things change every year, every 2 years. And you're almost you have to keep up with the newest stuff.
Yeah, that we're seeing,
especially on the web now. Flash is pretty much dead. Adobe is killing Flash Mobile, and Flash Desktop's not going to be very far behind. Microsoft Silverlight, some of the other proprietary technologies. Web authoring is now all HTML5, CSS, and JavaScript, using Perl and Ruby and right. newer Python, newer languages.
Right.
And web stuff changes so fast that you almost have to keep up every year, every 2 years.
Yeah, it's hard. All right, we have Joan from Rush on the line. Welcome, Joan. What's your question?
My question is, how do I stop my printer from printing a test sheet every time I turn it on and give it a command to print? I've been in the control panel. There are no documents in the queue.
The test page is a function in the control panel. There should be something under settings or service to
just
turn off that test page.
Let me go back.
Well, hold on a second. What? Something you said. Do you leave your printer off until you're ready to?
Yes.
Print well. The printer itself will mm-hmm. have a function that says when you're turned on, print a test page. So if you were to turn your printer on and leave it on all day. And I'm not saying you should do that. I understand why you turn it off. But I'm saying if you were to do that, you wouldn't get the test page for every print. You'd only get it once in the morning.
And in the printer control panel, there should be an option to turn that test page off.
Yep.
Okay.
Right. And it's
I'm
not
in the
by...
control panel, and I'm going to my printer now.
No, on your computer. On the control panel on the printer.
Oh.
Right. Somewhere in every printer, in the manual, it tells you all the defaults that are turned on and how to turn them off. And so in that manual, you go into that control panel, the one on the printer itself. Again, you want to read in the manual first. And then somewhere it will say test page on or off, and you turn it off. And then you won't see the test page anymore.
I've had this printer for years, several years, and it has never done this. Before.
It might have gotten zapped or something that set it back to the factory.
Some sort of reset that set it back to the factory default.
What model printer is it?
Pardon?
What model printer is it?
It's an HP C3100, but my granddaughter reminded me that I now have a new a laptop attached to it, but it didn't do that before I inserted our new cartridge.
Yeah, it may be that well, one
this
of two things.
This is an inkjet. Inkjets generally don't have startup pages. Only LaserJets do.
Yeah.
And it's an HP demo page or something like that?
Yeah, what does the page that gets printed out say?
It has black lines. It doesn't say a thing.
Oh, then it's not a test page.
Okay.
So, yeah,
well, it might be the ink test.
It looks like the ink test.
Yeah, it's possible. Do you have the HP software installed on your computer?
I'm presuming I do, but
well, every once in a while, do you see? Do you often see a pop up? Not often, but once in a while, a pop up that says running low on
ink.
Ink.
Yes.
Yeah. That's the HP software.
The other thing it likely is that might be an alignment page if it's a bunch of parallel lines. With inkjet printers, when you put in new cartridges, often the printer wants you to do an alignment process to
right.
align all four colors. You have to finish that alignment process before it will stop doing the alignment process.
And that should be in the HP software that you got. You should be able to perform a number of tests. The HP software is probably down in the system tray in the lower right side of your screen. There's one of those little icons, and it may be hidden, so you have to. There's a little left arrow. To see more of them, you want to find that HP software icon and read through what it has available. And it may be that software is trying to perform either an alignment test or something else, and you need to finish that or turn off the test page or whatever it's going to ask you to do before you can move on.
And there may be something on the printer's front control panel asking you which of these lines is best and to finish that alignment page.
Right.
Huh.
So give that a try, and let us know next week what happens. Call a little earlier. We're not going to take a break at all. We're done. Thank you, Joan. We're done for another week. You've wasted 2 hours of your life listening to us. And on a lovely 40-degree day in Rochester, New York, in the end of January, that's not a bad thing to do. I want to thank everybody who called in. I want to thank Joan and apologize that we had to cut her off. Next week, call earlier. And, of course, more often. The German show is coming in. George is going to be playing that rousing German music. Linda's going to keep him in line. And we'll be back next Saturday on the longest-running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Here are the club calendar highlights for